You can have all the knowledge and skill set in the world, but if you don't have the capacity to service a client's needs or a project, you're of little value. We need to ask ourselves, what are we looking for in a town planner or any professional consultant? And I guess I can boil that down to three kind of key things. One is...
Today, we've got another exceptional property podcast, and we've got Harley Day here from RPS.
Housing affordability, cost of living crisis is one of the biggest challenges of our generation. It's such a mammoth task to try and solve a problem like this because it is. If that's not done in a sensitive and responsible way, that can actually be quite counterproductive because that can threaten the viability of housing projects, which means...
What's your thoughts on development moving forward? Like, where do you see the opportunity for developers? How do we fix this housing problem as well?
It's a good question. And I think...
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. Today, we've got another exceptional property podcast, and we've got Harley Day here from RPS, and I just want to say thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And we've got...
Familiar face, Carson. Howdy. Oh, excited to pick Harley's brain again. So it's good.
Yeah, good. And Shannon, thanks for coming.
Great to be here, mate. Excited.
Just to introduce Harley. Harley is the principal planner and practice leader at RPS. And they do a range of disciplines, ranging from urban design, surveying, landscape architecture, town planning, and project management. So we're going to delve into a fair few of those different details and why it's important for the listeners to know what all of those disciplines actually are. And for those of you guys that don't know, I want to introduce our panel. We've got Shannon and Carson from Salt Developments. Shannon and Carson came on as coaching clients over 12 months ago now, probably about 14 months ago with Unemployable Coaching. And they're just absolute legends. And we've decided that we were going to launch a property coaching program. And the reason why you guys need to listen to these guys is 4 years ago, Carson was literally cleaning carpets. And he was actually cleaning carpets in a business that I used to own that I didn't even know who he was, never met him. And basically, yeah, that was unbelievable. And Shannon was literally a machine operator. And 4 years later, they've accumulated over $100 million worth of land and around 170 different subdivision lots of land. And they're just absolute humble guys. And we're going to be doing these property podcasts more regularly to help all you listeners out there do the exact same thing these guys did. And they did it with zero money to start with. And if you guys follow their journey and follow the podcast, you'll learn more and more about that. But we're not here to talk too much about Shannon and Carson today. We're here to talk about Harley and what value he can add to us on the panel and you guys as well. So Harley, tell us a little bit, I guess, about your background and how you got into town planning and, yeah, a bit about your business.
Well, I've been in the town planning and development industry for over 20 years. I started that journey in Brisbane. Got a town planning degree from the University of Queensland. I spent the first 12 years of my career working for local government in southeast Queensland. Spent some time out at Ipswich City Council and then moved to the Gold Coast City Council. Spent about 10 years working there, primarily in assessing development applications for the council. At that time, I changed careers slightly and went into the law. So I went and got a law degree and worked for a local legal firm practicing in planning and environment law. So I spent about 5 years in that practice. And then I moved on to a small software startup company where we developed software for town planning purposes. And thereafter joined RPS, where I've been a principal planning consultant for the last few years. And we primarily deal with developer and government clients there.
So when you say developer and government clients, when you say a government client, what type, you don't have to say who that is, but like what type of client is that? Is that roads? Is that infrastructure?
Yeah, look, all of those things.
Yeah.
We have a number of projects on the go at any one time for whether it's the federal government, the state government, or the local governments. Typically, those projects involve the delivery of infrastructure. So might be roads, might be parks and open spaces, schools, hospitals, and those types of things.
Yep. And you predominantly do town planning?
Correct. Yes.
And what actually does a town planner do? What does your day-to-day look like, and why should people be wanting to learn about what a town planner does?
Well, I guess for your audience, which I understand are interested in private property development, I suppose those people come to us for usually advice in the first instance. So Shannon and Carson can relate to this. They might be looking for some early advice about property they're thinking about purchasing or they've already purchased. So that might include some due diligence investigations, trying to understand what the development potential of that land is and the pathways or the approvals that they'll need to go through in able to allow that development to occur. So more often than not, any significant development requires a development approval. There are often several approvals that are required before you can actually complete that development. So a town planner will provide that advice to property owners typically to let them know what they'll need to do or what the development potential is to allow that development to be realized.
And how do you guys actually work? So when should a person engage a town planner?
Well, I guess if you're thinking about buying property for the purpose of developing that property, it's pretty critical that you have an understanding of what rules apply and what can realistically be achieved on that land. So before you get too far down the track or invest too much time or money in a property, it's good to have a basic understanding of what those limitations might be for a site. So contacting a town planner at the earliest possible time is worth your time and money doing. When it comes to actually wanting to progress the development, the town planner can provide you with the services to obtain the required development approvals. So you asked about my typical day. My typical day might involve fielding inquiries from existing or new clients on projects that might be either just an idea at the early inception or might be somewhat advanced. Much of my time is spent advocating on behalf of our clients and preparing and advancing development applications in order for them to secure the development approvals that they need to do the development they're interested in doing.
Mm. Now, how are you guys working with Harley at the moment?
Well, a lot of due diligence for a lot of sites, just the ones you buy, it's the ones you don't buy that can be the make and break in this game. So, we, as much as me and Shannon have kicked some goals, we know we're only one or two bad projects away from cleaning carpets again. And so at the end of the day, the due diligence piece is critical. And that's, one of the reasons we engaged Harley. We knew he had a lot of experience through council, and then also that legal side of things. We know that's a different brain that's in the background as well, working with, whenever he's assessing the site. So we got another layer of due diligence that a lot of planners may not go to the same detail as what Harley does. He'll pick through not just his report, but he'll pick up stuff in consultants' reports. A lot of planners will just throw in a ecologist report or a acoustic report, and you know the good planners that are actually finding issues in other consultants' reports. And normally they just get picked up in a request for information when council reviewed it and come back with the question. So little things like that, we noticed with Harley, he's very diligent at those things. And we had a particular hairy one over the border that was a court approval. And we were just like, oh, if we're going to look at this, we need someone that's, got a legal brain and a planning brain, because it was too big and hairy for us. And in the end, we did drop it. But, you couldn't even assess a site like that
you know, properly without having someone like Harley in your team. So that's when we engaged him, and we're working with him on some other projects now. So,
yeah. And how did you guys find out about Harley?
Through school, actually. Our kids all go to the same school, and that was where I first ran across each other, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Word of mouth, perhaps.
You were coaching my young fella for basketball as well. At school. So that's when we first met, and got to there.
How good are they? So the school fees have been paid for. And I'm sure they've been paid for many years.
Getting there slowly.
Were you going to say something, Shannon?
I was going to ask Harley, because he's got such an interesting brain. And like you said, it's embarrassing sometimes, actually, that what you pull us up on and the little, you don't miss a trick. Sometimes you come back or you get an email back and I'm just like, I should have seen that.
Humble pie.
Yeah, he really, really doesn't miss anything. You humble us all the time. In your opinion, when you're looking for a planner and looking for what are the questions that you asked, or what would you ask people to ask if they're trying to find a good planner like yourself? Like what's a, because you've seen many different sides, but you've had the council side, so you've seen what good applications look like, you've got that legal side, you've got obviously your town planning side itself. So
yeah, that's a good question. And I think before we kind of figure out what questions to ask, I think we need to ask ourselves, what are we looking for in a town planner or any professional consultant? And I guess I can boil that down to three kind of key things. One is their knowledge. The next is their skill set. And the third is their capacity. So, you know, knowledge is pretty self-explanatory. You want to make sure that you're engaging consultants that are knowledgeable on the subject matter. Do they know their stuff? You know, do they know the processes? Do they know the people? In terms of the skill set, do they have the skills that you find valuable in a consultant? Do they have the skills to be able to get the outcomes that you're striving to achieve? Do they have the skills to be able to communicate effectively with you? Yeah. Town planners often work in teams of various sub-consultants or other specialist experts. So it's important that, yeah, a good planner is a good team player. And then that third one in terms of capacity, you can have all the knowledge and skill set in the world, but if you don't have the capacity to service a client's needs or a project, you're of little value. So I would be looking to ask questions that seek to reveal whether that planner has those three key attributes. So in terms of the knowledge side of things, asking them about their previous experience, usually a copy of their CV or their resume will highlight that. So you can see, okay, this person's got a fair amount of experience. They should have the knowledge. Asking them about what they see as being kind of the key risks associated with a particular project also helps give us insight about their knowledge. Similarly, I guess their skill set will be evident from talking to them, seeing what they're like as a communicator, seeing what runs they have on the board in terms of being able to deliver outcomes for clients.
What sort of projects they've done, if there's any tricky parts.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I guess, never discount how valuable it can be talking to their other clients and reaching out to your networks about who they've engaged in the past and what good and bad experiences they may have had. But that capacity question is often the more difficult thing to kind of gauge.
Because everybody wants the work, right? Like, and that's the thing, is setting expectations up front, because in this game, time is everything. Like I'm dealing with a site at the moment where we're going for an extension on terms, right? And he's come back and said straight no, right? So now we're like, okay, we're 4 days out and what are we going to do, right? So are we going to run the gauntlet and just go, no, we have to keep pursuing with this and we've got a little bit of time to settle? Or do we go back and say, okay, rather than a 21-day extension, you know, ask for maybe a 7-day and just get another week up our sleeve? Because time, like I said before, is everything, right? With you guys, when you're on contract and you're putting due diligence clauses and whatnot, sometimes you can get longer ones, sometimes you don't. So if you're dealing with a town planner and they say, yeah, I got the capacity, no problem, and all of a sudden they start screwing you around and they're not getting back to you straight away, and it's 3 weeks later and you're already 3 weeks into an 8 week due diligence clause, that's going to be a massive problem. And that capacity one is very, very important. And I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you a question about that. Because no one wants to give away work, right? But you're rather under promise and over deliver. So how do you guys manage that? So when someone comes to RPS and talk to Harley, how do you measure that capacity? How do you actually say, yes, I can take you on or not?
Well, I guess it's about going in with your eyes open and understanding what the needs of the project are, but also understanding where your organization's at and what you can deliver and what you can promise on. So the reputable planning consultant companies out there are often backed up by really strong, diverse teams within those companies. And when we're, I guess, pitching to a new client, or we're putting forward fee proposals for new projects, we will detail who are the people we intend to work on that project. And we always have a number of kind of backups or contingencies for that. So we have quite a strong team of planners that we can lean on in times when the demands for our time are high. Some of the smaller, I guess, operators that might just be sole operators or a few planners within a smaller company might not have that depth of resourcing to rely on. So we're quite upfront about that and really promote that as one of our strong suits, and that we've got quite a depth of planners with really diverse skill sets, really good knowledge that we can draw upon to assist deliver for our clients time and time again. And the other thing that I make sure that I always try to achieve is a high level of accessibility for my clients. So, I can't always answer the phone, but I make sure if I miss a call from a client, I get back to them. Yeah, I'm sure that most of my clients value that really highly, is that when they need to talk to me about something, I make it a real point to ensure that I am accessible, and I do take time out of my day to make sure I get back to all my clients within a really short time frame.
Yeah, good. That's very, very important. And that's a thing of the past, to be honest with you. There's a lot of times where people just aren't getting back to you, and that's an issue. I don't know if it's just in this country, but I'm still waiting on quotes from 6 weeks ago from people that I don't just aren't coming, yet they spent the time. I just don't understand it. It's just,
I feel your pain. I mean, part of what we do sometimes is we engage sub-consultants. So what I mean by that is that a client of ours will come to us and say, we want to make a development application for, say, a residential subdivision. And we'll provide them with advice on what other consultants we expect to need input from. And so sometimes they'll ask us to go and find and engage those sub-consultants. And we'll go out and sometimes seek fee proposals for more than one. And quite often there'll be a significant delay from some of them. And I often question, whether they're acting in their own best interest by doing that. And I appreciate that everyone's a bit busy, but it can be quite detrimental to your reputation. And in this game, reputation is so important. And that's why I, make sure that I try and do everything I can to service our clients well and maintain a really good reputation, not just amongst our clients, but also the authorities that sit on the other side of what our clients are trying to do. So when I talk about authorities, I'm talking about government agencies typically. So making sure that we have a good relationship with the government agencies who will ultimately decide and determine the outcome of development applications. It's really important to try and maintain good relationships on that side of the fence as well.
Yeah, because you've been on that side of the fence, what makes a good application? The first planner I engaged, he was like, oh, let's just throw it in so we can get the clock ticking without any of the, with missing three or four other reports. I later found out, and councils never recommend or try and discourage you not using consultants, but I actually had someone in council say, why are you using that guy? Like, find somebody else. I didn't know. I was wet behind the ears, and I thought he was decent. But so what makes a good application? And when knowing, you've sat on the other side of the fence, What is a good application, and what should you be, you know, wanting your planner, you know, to be doing to make that application, give yourself the best chance? Because I'm sure if it lands on their lap and it's not, yeah, it's not correct, or there's issues or errors, it's just gonna, you know, they're just gonna give you a rubbish, you know, response, and it's just gonna kick the can down the road, probably a lot longer than it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah. Look, certainly the bare minimum approach is something I try and avoid at all costs. But if you take it from the earliest possible time when preparing a development application or working up a concept for development generally, if you approach that task through a lens of trying to achieve a good outcome, that's a really good starting point. So what are we actually trying to achieve here? Are we trying to achieve, say, a housing development? How can we do that, ensuring that we ultimately are going to deliver a product that is desirable, has good outcomes, and limits any negative impacts? Now, depending on the complexity of the project, sometimes there's great value in engaging with the local authorities, council, state government, in pre-lodgement discussions. So before you even get to finalising that development application and lodging it with the relevant authority, having what's called pre-lodgement discussions can be really valuable to identifying any significant issues that you might face with getting the approval that you want to get once you've lodged it. So Shannon Carson and I have sat in a room with council officers many times and state government officers many times where we present an initial concept and talk through the significant issues. We then take that information away, the feedback that we get from those authorities, and we look for ways in which we can address those concerns, because that time and money spent up front can often be paid back in dividends later on when you get an approval through the system a lot quicker than if you hadn't have spent that time up front. So I guess the first point I'm trying to make here is that pre-lodgement discussions and responding to the feedback before you lodge can be the hallmark of a good application. Then when you lodge that application, there's some really critical aspects that you need to get right. There's effectively three things. There's making sure that you have the owner's consent when it's required. If you mess that up, that can be critical. The second thing is making sure you have the right forms and the mandatory information to submit with that application. And the third thing is payment of fees. So they're kind of the three things that you need to tick the box for before you get through that first gate of being a properly made application. But that is the bare minimum.
What is a pre-lodgement meeting for those that don't know? And when can you get a pre-lodgement meeting? So first question, what is it? Second question is, I'm nervous, it's my first time, and you know, I've got due diligence up my sleeve, whether it's a subdivision of land or a duplex or a triplex or whatever that is. Do you still push those through pre-lodgement meetings? When do you actually go to a pre-lodgement meeting? Why would you go to one? So what is it? And I guess,
yeah, I guess the only precursor, or the only condition, I suppose, for a pre-lodgement meeting is that it's a meeting that happens before lodgement. You know, yep. It's in the name, right?
Yep.
So it effectively it contemplates that you'll be lodging some type of application after that meeting. So there's no limitation effectively on when you can have a pre-lodgement meeting. And pre-lodgement meetings are facilitated or hosted by the authorities. So either the local government councils or state government assessment agencies, for example. And so typically you might have a meeting with any of those entities as part of a due diligence period or investigation. So if you're thinking about buying a property and you might have it under contract and it's subject to achieving a certain development approval for that site and you want to know the authority's response to certain development proposals or issues that might arise, you would request a meeting with those authorities. And typically those authorities would ask you to detail in making the application for that meeting. What are the issues do you want to discuss? What's on the agenda? What are the big ticket items you want feedback on? So if you had a proposal that was 100% compliant with all the requirements and was almost guaranteed to be approved because there were no real issues, typically we wouldn't recommend you have a pre-lodgement meeting for that. Seems to be a waste of time and resources.
So if you're pushing boundaries a little bit, probably a good time to actually see what you can get away with.
Yeah. Well, that's a way of putting it. Yeah, for sure. So what we're looking for in most instances with pre-lodgement meetings is a response about some non-compliances effectively, pushing those boundaries. So for example, say there's a height control of 10 stories in place and we want to push for a development that's perhaps 12 stories. We might want to seek feedback from the assessing authorities about how they might respond to that type of development application and what are ways that we can perhaps address any of their concerns to deal with those matters.
For the newcomers, right, what platforms or what recommendations would you give them for tools, I guess, to learn a little bit more about TAM planning? Obviously, go on ChatGPT and put it in there, but is there any free platforms that you can say before ringing Harley and going, I know zero about town planning, don't waste my time, go and do a 2 or 3 hour deep dive into these platforms? Are there any that you would recommend?
There are.
Just to get their head.
Yeah, look, there's several tools online, and there's a wealth of information online, whether it's state government websites or council websites. But I'd never say it's too early to reach out for advice from a planner.
Yep.
I'd never turn someone away and say, go and do your own research on that before coming to talking to a town planner.
Yep.
Because it is such a complex industry in which we work, there's so many potential traps and risks associated with the development game that to send someone off to do their own research on those matters would be a pretty tall ask.
On the flip side with that, though, do you want clients to come to you? Like when you're starting out, you don't want me, every time I see in realestate.com, develop, DA, all these, subdivision potential, and we're just flicking you 5 sites a week. After a while, you're going to, you're like, sorry, mate, there's going to be an end of the friendship at some point in time because you're trading time for money at the end of the day. So to give some tools of maybe just some generic first, things to run the site through before we can get to you, so we're not bombarding you with sites. Yeah, what are those ones that we can first touch points, I guess?
Yeah, look, it's a minefield, right? And there's a wealth of information that you could that you can access. I guess the first port of call for a lot of town planners and would-be developers is to look at what are the local planning controls. And when I talk about planning controls, I'm talking about planning schemes, which often will in a very convoluted way, try to explain what the planning rules are, what the limitations, what the constraints are for land in a local government area. So most people would be familiar with land use zoning. So land is typically the subject of a zoning under a planning scheme or a planning instrument. On the Gold Coast, we have a planning scheme called City Plan. And those zones typically express what type of development outcomes are expected for land in that zone. So, for example, you might have a residential zone or you might have an industrial zone. And so in the name kind of explains what type of development's expected in that zone. But not all zones are created equal and not all planning rules are hard and fast.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a planning world where there's performance-based outcomes, which means quite often there's no strict black and white yes-no answers to can I develop this particular site for a particular purpose. Quite often the answer to those questions is yes but or yes if, or no if. And so there's a lot of variables. So doing your own research is good. So, yeah, checking the local planning scheme for the zone and understanding what's contemplated. So if a zone, if a site is zoned for residential development and you want to put an abattoir in there or a chicken farm, chances are you're going to have a very difficult time getting that approved.
And in within those zones, you then have density, right? So you've got, you know, low density, medium density, high density. So can you just touch base a little bit just on what that actually means? Like you're in a residential zone, and I know it chops and changes a little bit, but just a rough kind of guide so people understand, you know, when they're looking at things. So they're, as an example, if they live in Burley Waters and they're in a, you know, they watch a podcast or they start talking to us about development, they're like, I've got an amazing site. You know, my neighbor is selling and it's a 600 square meter block and I want to build 3 units on it, but they're in a low density zone. That's obviously going to be very hard to push. So can you just touch base a little bit maybe on just the low density, medium density and high density kind of zoning in residential just for now? Just
yeah, sure.
An example.
Sure. So typically low density residential zones are intended for effectively really low scale residential development. So detached single dwellings. In some instances, you might be able to get a second dwelling on a lot that's large enough, but effectively that's what the planning instruments intend for that land, is that they're predominantly single detached dwellings. There'll be other constraints and overlays that might apply to land and certain allowances, for example, things like building height. So you might have a low density residential zone with a building height limit, and I use the term limit quite loosely, but limit of say 2 or 3 stories. So when you put that together, you can understand that, okay, if I want to do a residential development that's 2 stories in a single dwelling, chances are that that will be something that doesn't cause too many problems and will be fairly easily to achieve. But what if you wanted to put, say, a childcare center on that land? That becomes exponentially more difficult. It's not to say it's impossible, but there's more hurdles that you have to jump over. Medium density residential zoning is the next step up in terms of intensity or density of dwellings. In those zones, what you can expect to see and what's intended for those zones is perhaps duplexes or townhouses or row houses, maybe even 2 to 3 story walk-up apartment buildings, those types of things. Then you've got your high density, which is typically what we see along much of the high-rise spine in the Gold Coast, your Surfers Paradise, your Broadbeach, where you see really tall buildings, lots of apartment dwellings, and that's those types of outcomes.
And you mentioned on the Gold Coast specifically, the city plan. Where can people find the city plan so that way they can see if their Burley Waters properties, their neighbor, is in low, medium, or high density?
You might be shocked by this, but if you go to Google and type in Gold Coast City Plan, it'll take you right there. So it is effectively that accessible. It is what we call open source data.
And that's the beauty of this, guys. And the reason why I'm asking these simple questions, some of you guys might be like, oh, come on, Eric. But the reality is a lot of this information is free to the public. And it's just a matter of, like Harley said, sitting there and Googling it or going on ChatGPT and asking some good questions. And I always recommend, you know, this is my opinion, don't call a town planner without doing that. Just wrap your head around it just a little bit, get an understanding of what's low density, medium density, high density, because let me tell you, guys like Harley are busy, right? And when they have someone contacting them, they're going to want to know that that person is serious, right? And they've done a little bit of, I guess, due diligence or a bit of education around the space. Because let me tell you, if you're going green as and just going, hey, can you look at this for me? And Harley's got 10 other clients that he's been working with for a long time, you're probably not speaking in you for you, but you could be maybe saying it different. If I'm the down planner, I wouldn't be taking you seriously. You'd probably be the last on the list. I'd still call you, but you're not going to be first on the list. Whereas if you come across and you say, hey, you know, I'd send him an email, a professional email saying, hi, I'm blah, blah, blah from, you know, X, you know, development company. And I've just been researching and I'm looking at this block of land. I know it's in a medium density zoning, but it's got three stories. And I'm thinking maybe I'm trying to push for a four story, push that. He's going to be like, okay, these guys kind of know what they're doing a little bit and take you more serious. So that's why I'm asking these simple things, because it's all there. It's all free. And then what I would highly, highly recommend doing, and I've said this to many, many coaching clients that we already have, is some of the best value that you can get is sitting down with a town planner and spending 1 to 2 hours of the time prepared with the right questions. And it might not even be on a specific site, just for your education purposes, because you can pay them right for your service to sit there. It might not be you, it might be a junior town planner, and sit there and ask the questions as well. So that way you can touch base. I highly, highly recommend that.
Definitely. Your town planner is your gateway. I highly said it earlier to all your other consultants. If you get a good town planner and you're as green as can be, they're going to hold your hand through that whole process. They'll have contacts with all the engineers and all the other consultants that you need. So you don't need to go finding all those. A planner can help build that team for you. So it's your job, like I said, is to find the right planner and interview a few and settle on one. But interesting, if I know you're not wearing your legal hat anymore, but what did you learn from that time that you spent in the legal world, and where do you see that avenue working well for developers, and where do you see it go south? I mean, I've seen developers puff their chest out and they're just going to court and they're going to sue, and it maybe not approach it the right way. And then a lot of developers I know that are doing townhouses, they're nearly taking every site to, in Victoria in particular, like they're going to court to get, you know, these little things that might not tick the box but are probably going to get approved through court. So where do you see it work well and with your clients when you're in that space? We can just shed a little bit of light.
You did.
So I guess the question seems to be about the appeal process. So when it comes to decisions on development applications, there is an opportunity to make an appeal against the decision of an assessing authority, so of a government, so whether it's council or the state government, if they're deciding a development application. An applicant, a developer, can appeal to the Planning and Environment Court in Queensland that decision. And there's also an opportunity to start those legal appeals in other circumstances as well. But let's just talk about the scenario where a council has decided to refuse your development application. You as an applicant in that scenario would typically have what's called appeal rights. So if you're not happy with the refusal, which most developers aren't, you would strongly be considering seeking legal advice and potentially filing an appeal. So in an appeal setting, ultimately, if that appeal goes the whole nine yards, that matter, that appeal will be decided by a judge, the court, effectively. If you're taking an appeal from start to finish, where you're asking a judge to decide that matter and deliver a judgment, that can be a very costly process, both in terms of time and money and risk of uncertainty on the outcome. Okay? So most appeals take at least 12 months to resolve themselves. And that's, and when you're thinking about the time, that's usually after you've spent at least 12 months getting that development application to that point, either to refusal or otherwise. So you've got this extra period of time that you need to account for, allow for, in allowing appeal to run its course. But then you have the cost, the money, the financial side of things. You have to engage a team of lawyers, a team of experts. If it goes through a contested hearing where you're asking a judge to decide a matter, you'll have barristers. And the fees continue to go up and up and up and up.
you'd want to be probably a fairly seasoned developer to go through this process, right? And obviously, no matter what consultant you have or who's representing you, like you said, it's not a guaranteed outcome. So you better have enough money to run the risk of the time and the cash to actually get that done. So I highly, I myself wouldn't be recommending anyone that's, no, you know, fairly new that say, I want to get 4 on here, nine there, or 5 on there, and they're only allowing 4. No, that's it. I'm going to go to court just so I can get that extra one. It's probably not the most ideal. And of course, you would probably recommend that as
well. Yeah, that's right. And those seasoned developers that do find themselves in those appeal settings recognize the value of compromise and negotiation.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it is not a quick process. And there are opportunities and requirements of that process to come to the table with the other parties in that appeal and see if you can negotiate or resolve the issues. And so if a developer has the opportunity to resolve an appeal before it gets before a judge, there's a lot of value in exploring that, because once it goes before a judge, the certainty or the risk around the outcome is largely an unknown. Because when things get to a contested hearing in court, often you have two sides that are arguing against each other for their particular preferred outcome. And both sides believe that they've got a good chance of winning. So quite often, the prospect of success for any one side is no better than 50-50.
Yeah.
So you're effectively flipping a coin on the outcome of a multi-million dollar development potentially that you have so much invested in. For what? For maybe an extra dwelling,
yeah,
or an extra story. So there's a lot of value in resolving or negotiating those issues before it gets to that point. But the other thing I think that Carson was kind of talking to was another scenario where in some planning jurisdictions or systems, there's an opportunity to file an appeal, to start an appeal process before the council or the agency has even decided the application. And we use this term deemed refusal. So effectively, council has taken too long and you're sick of waiting for them to make a decision for council to either approve or you refuse your development application.
Right.
In some instances, you have the ability to start an appeal process. And that tactic is sometimes used to bring matters to a head, where a developer may have advice to say, look, you know, council's just dragging the chain. They're potentially going to take another 12 months to decide this. If we file an appeal now, we can force their hand and bring the courts in to try and facilitate an outcome quicker. But again, that process is not a quick process and it's going to cost you a lot of time and money. So getting that early advice before you pull that trigger is really important. So informed town planners and legal practitioners can help inform you of you know, the risks and the opportunities that might exist in commencing an appeal. But in the majority of instances, you don't want to find yourself in an appeal setting.
Yeah, that's good.
At the beginning of the pod, you mentioned a range of disciplines from urban design, surveying, landscape architect, town planning, project management. Can you just guide the audience through the process, right? Because that's a lot of different disciplines. And can you guide them through the process of when you would engage each of those, because some of these you have to engage, others are optional, and explain, yeah, the process and which ones are actually mandatory and which ones are optional.
Look, I'd say that
let's use it on a splitter as an example. You buy a block and you want to split it into two blocks and subdivide it.
I guess that's a pretty straightforward development that application in that instance, I guess the bare minimum. I mean, it's debatable whether a town planner is even required in that instance,
yep,
but let's say a town planner,
yep,
and a surveyor.
Yep.
Right? You need, effectively, the town planner can assist you with making the relevant development applications,
yep,
and managing that process. But you also need a surveyor, a land surveyor, to survey the land and prepare the subdivision plan effectively. So that plan showing the lines on the page to show where the new proposed boundaries will go.
What does a land surveyor actually do?
A land surveyor surveys the land and prepares records about property boundaries effectively, topographies and those types of matters.
So for those of you guys that don't know what a land surveyor is, when you're driving down the street and you see these random dudes in high vis with these big tripods with this kind of camera and laser kind of, and you're wondering, I wonder what they're doing. That is a land surveyor.
They do maths in the sun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting though. Like when you actually look at it and all the points they got to make just to get you that report, like it's a fair bit of work. You know, you need to know what you're doing. So
it's that time of year again at Unemployable, where we're opening up our Unemployable business coaching program. It's over a 12-month period. And with that, you get private one-on-one coaching, group coaching, as well as private and live events throughout the year. You can get private coaching with me, and not only me, but our panel of experts that we have put together. These panel of experts have been in our network and are the exact people that we use in our business successes. People from branding, sales, marketing, our lawyers, our accountants, everyone that has helped build our businesses, you have access to. If this sounds of interest, go to www.unemployable.com.au/coaching and register your interest to see if it's a fit for you and us. Hope to see you there.
So that would be on a land subdivision, right? Just a very straightforward one. Now, if you go to the next level and you're going, okay, I want to do what Shannon and Carson are doing as an example.
Sure.
And I've got a site. They like to call it warts, right? There's a bit of warts on it, right? There's a bit of koala habitat. We've got a bit of a ravine going through it. We've got some flooding issues. But we think we can, you know, everyone's scared of it, but we think we could get 30 lots on here. And we want to take it all the way through to construction. We want to build the roads. We want to build the infrastructure, which is plumbing and electricity and the likes. And then we want to just sell the blocks of land. What would that process look like?
A whole team of consultants.
And when do you engage? What's the timeline? When do you actually engage the landscape architect versus the town planner versus the surveyor, you know, these types of
sure.
project manager?
Yeah. I mean, the answer to that question will depend on the case-by-case scenario and depending on how much information is already available. So in some instances, you might already have survey plans already there. And so that information you already have at hand might allow you to delay the engagement of more survey work. But let's just assume in this scenario, you have basically nothing.
We could work on a real event that we're working on now, if you like. We haven't lodged yet. And we've already engaged how many different consultants?
Yeah, that's right.
Let's do that as an example, right? Because I want people to start understanding a little bit of what's involved from a consultant perspective without getting overwhelmed.
Sure.
Because I remember when I first got into development, and then I started understanding, you know, when we did our first mid-rise and the amount of consultants that you had to engage, I was dumbfounded. Now it's no problem, but at the beginning.
Yeah. So I think the example that Shannon was referring to, in that case, we were dealing with a fairly large piece of land with several different constraints. And so bringing a town planner in at the earliest possible time was pretty critical. But also, because there are environmental constraints, we needed an ecologist to come in and do a survey of the ecological values of that land.
And what does an ecologist do?
An ecologist looks at effectively the natural environment.
Yeah.
So, fauna and flora. So, vegetation and animals.
Yep.
Waterways, those types of things. What are the values, the ecological and environmental values that are present on this land? How do we navigate the relevant environmental controls or restrictions or rules that relate to development where you have perhaps some environmental values on land that are protected?
Yeah.
So understanding those constraints is really important.
So town planner, you then got the ecologist on board.
Yep. Engineering and civil infrastructure expertise is also critical to understanding the infrastructure capacity So when I talk about infrastructure capacity, what I mean by that is when we talk about doing residential development, we need to understand what type of infrastructure is essential for delivering that development outcome. So infrastructure is a broad term that can include things like water and sewer, stormwater, roads, and also parks. Typically, a civil engineer will deal with those first four, water, sewer, stormwater, and roads. And then you might have a planner that looks at, you know, the parks infrastructure as well. So a civil engineer is really vital to doing some early investigations to see what is the infrastructure capable of sustaining in terms of extra development. So when you do a residential development, you need to connect it to the water infrastructure, the city or the town water. Is there enough capacity in that infrastructure to service that development?
And how far away it is from the actual development site as well. Right?
Because that can be a massive cost and risk for a development. If you find out that in order to deliver the development you're proposing, you need to improve or expand on the existing infrastructure, that could kill the viability of a project straight away. So understanding those limitations is really key. So we've got now, you know, a planner, an ecologist, a civil engineer.
Yep.
But then you need to also look at, I guess, the other constraints on the land. So one of the big ticket items in our part of the world is bushfire constraints and flooding, right? So making sure that if your site is prone to flooding or bushfire risk, that you've got an expert that can look into those matters and give you some advice about how your development can respond to those constraints.
Yeah.
Quite often when it comes to bushfire, the issues there are interconnected with matters of ecology. More trees often means more bushfire risk.
Yeah.
Quite often there are rules around what trees you can clear. And also there are rules around how close you can build to trees because of the bushfire risk. So having that expert opinion from both an ecologist who tells you what trees you need to protect, but also a bushfire expert that tells you what trees you might need to remove is pretty critical to understanding whether your development has any risks associated with it.
And this is when you're looking at the overlays, and if there is bushfire risk there, that's when, and if it's big enough, that's when you would say, okay, this is out of the ecologist pay grade, you now got to get a bushfire expert as an example to be brought in on as another consultant.
A lot of people bring in engineers and all those consultants you mentioned, but I know a lot of friends of mine that have really killed their fees or just taken a hit to the bottom line by not engaging their electrical engineer early enough as well, because you know, not having, putting in a new transformer and running that, they're thinking about, okay, engineer, okay, how much per lot is it going to be? Okay, great, put it in the feasibility, and they're not even thinking about the $450,000 for the electrical side of things, or in some parts of the world, your traffic allocations. If they're trying to upgrade a road and they're not allowing any new development until that road is upgraded, you might even have the right zone, perfect piece of dirt, and you still can't develop it because until the government actually upgrades that road, and you're never going to do it because it's too expensive. You've got a project, you're just waiting for council. So your traffic engineers early in the piece as well, and it's more probably for the larger projects, but those things start coming into play that you're not really thinking about when you're starting out.
That's really good insight. That is really good insight. The electrical infrastructure is another piece of infrastructure which is often left to later and can have
always dismissed.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's, I think from an assessment perspective, it's often not something that's in the forefront of the assessing authorities' minds in terms of council or state government. If left till the 11th hour, you might find that it just kills your whole feasibility. Mm-hmm. We had a client that was doing a relatively modest subdivision, and we identified that one of the lots couldn't be connected to mains power. And in order to do so, he was going to have to build 5 kilometres worth of overhead power lines just to service this one particular lot. And in doing so, that would require significant earthworks, removal of protected vegetation, and it nearly killed the whole project. So that's a really good case study of why getting that upfront advice about electrical infrastructure is really important, and all other types of infrastructure. The transport side of things is really critical too. Like you said, there's planning controls and rules around development, ensuring that it doesn't create undue impact on transport infrastructure. And there's enough capacity in roads, for example, and that if you do a development and that triggers the need to upgrade an intersection, for example, that's a piece of work that could cost you millions of dollars and kill the viability of a project.
So, like, then go ahead.
Even now, we've engaged for the noise coming off that main road because we're close to it. So, we've got an acoustic report there now.
Yeah, that's another good one. So, there are planning controls around ensuring that you achieve in development suitable outcomes with respect to noise impacts. So, if you're proposing residential development in proximity to a noise source like a state-controlled road
or a
rail stop or some other source of noise, you need to demonstrate that the development outcome achieves a certain acoustic or noise criteria. And often there's another consultant with specialist expertise in that field that you need to bring in as well. So you can see the team of consultants is growing. So I guess in the first instance, determining how many different consultants you need to engage at the earliest possible opportunity largely depends on a bit of a due diligence investigation and that first fly over the target from a planner typically to say, okay, here are the constraints. These are the consultants we think we might need to engage in the first instance. And here are some of the other consultants we might need to engage in the longer term. Mm. So when we talk about some of those other consultants, urban designers are often needed in the early stages to assist with designing public spaces or subdivision layouts. So subdivision layouts and road layouts and lot designs and things like that are pretty critical in the early stages to understanding what is the type of yield or number of lots I can achieve realistically out of a development. The landscape architects are typically not necessarily required really early on and might be engaged a little bit later when you're starting to finalize your development application and it needs a bit more detail around what type of landscaping are we proposing here and putting details into your development application about that. Then there's also project managers who are really valuable in assisting with managing more complex developments so they can assist with those early due diligence investigations, which involve large numbers of different consultants, that can also manage the project all the way through to construction and delivery.
So what I see here is, the town planner, right, is like the main conduit, right, for a lot of the other consultants. Because you guys, there's almost like a project management part to what you guys do without even calling it project management, right?
We call it coordination.
Yeah.
So we don't want to steal the thunder of our project manager colleagues. So we call it project coordination.
Yeah.
So that often involves coordination of a team of consultants.
Yeah.
But I don't discount the value of bringing in a specialist project manager for these larger projects.
Yeah, I agree. And is that something that, Shannon, are you guys looking at anytime now or in the future? I know you guys have managed a lot of your projects, but your projects are becoming bigger and bigger. So where's the headspace in regards to when do you actually engage a project manager and going, okay, we're actually very busy now? And what are your thoughts on that?
Delivering the projects has been a key part for us in the early stages. You're in the grind and you're making the projects happen and you're saving as much as you can so you can get into the next project. As we're starting to do more, we're starting to realize the company's growing and there's opportunity now, or lost opportunity, in projects that we're not finding either. So we can manage that process, that bring a project manager in and help us with the execution of projects, help us on the back end doing development management and working with people like Harley as well. We'll be able to bring more deals into the pipeline and try and manage them.
It's an opportunity cost, really, right? Like it's
We all get into the same headspace, whether it's business or property. You want to try and do as much as you can to, you know, save 10 grand here, but you just lost out on $1 million over here because that block of land just sold at auction that you would have bought.
Yeah.
But you forgot to put it in your calendar because you're saving 10 grand over here. And it's so important. That's why I'm big on, you know, we all are big on getting guys like you, Harley, onto the podcast to explain how important the town planning part of property development is, and as well as the rest of the disciplines and all these other experts that you have to have on board. And obviously, RPS would have great relationships with a lot of these other disciplines. So when people are thinking, how do I find an engineer and an ecologist and a bushfire and an acoustic guy? And, you know, you guys already have a lot of those relationships, which is great. And my next question is, do you, when you guys are managing those relationships and referring those people, are you just referring them out of the goodness of your heart because they're on the Rolodex? Or, you know, is there any funny business that goes on? Because I know that there's a lot of times in this industry, there's been plenty of funny business. So how do you guys manage that?
Well,
put you on the spot a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I think the way I operate and a lot of my colleagues operate is that we, in terms of who we refer and who we bring in on projects, is decided based on what's best for the project and what's best for the client. So, yes, we have a lot of existing relationships with other consultants, and sometimes we know that one particular consultant, let's say a traffic engineer, has particular expertise in a particular geographic region or location, and we might suggest we bring them in because we know they have that expert knowledge, they've got some runs on the board in that particular location, and so we'll suggest we bring them in. And those consultants that we have good working relationships with that continue to perform at a high level will also be at the top of the list in terms of who we recommend engaging. Mm-hmm. At RPS, we have affiliated companies, I suppose, mm-hmm. that work in some of those related fields. So we'll often look at what their capabilities are and we'll throw them into the mix too if it's what serves the client and the project best.
Yeah.
Wanted to get your thoughts. RPS, we have a pretty good bird's eye view on, yeah, like you said, a lot of state and local councils and what's going on. You're part of UDIA and some of these groups that are talking to, you know, these state and council bodies all the time. What's your thoughts on development moving forward? Like, where do you see the opportunity for developers? How do we fix this housing problem as well? Like, what do you see are the roadblocks? And do you see, is it just as simple as there's too much red tape, or with a stroke of a pen you could change some things? Like, if you were the authority and you could make some moves, what would those moves be to open up more development in your world?
Can I add to that?
Yeah, okay.
Because we've been to a lot of the UDIA meetings and we've seen a lot of this stuff. And just locally, there's a big push, say, down, what do you call it, the spine, the Gold Coast spine?
High-rise spine.
Yep. The high-rise spine. That's where it's trying to densify at the moment. That's where we've got Southport and the light rails going in and all these bits and pieces where they do want to densify and go up. But that's a challenging cost. So how can that be, like Carson said, how can that be counteracted where... How do you see it being more of an opportunity to deliver housing?
Well, thanks for the easy question. Because it's such a wicked problem how we describe it. Yeah, this housing crisis, this housing affordability, cost of living crisis is one of the biggest challenges of our generation. Yeah, it's such a mammoth task to try and solve a problem like this, because it is truly multifaceted.
Mm.
It's not just a town planning issue. It's a more national or global issue that we face. And there's no easy solutions. There's no silver bullets. We need our greatest minds kind of working together to solve this one. And that, I guess, if we look at it from a top-down approach in terms of, at the Australian government or federal government level, Now, there's certain things that they can do to facilitate more housing, but they can't do it alone. They need to have a collaborative approach with state government, local government, and the development industry and the community more broadly. Now, the federal government can take some really meaningful steps towards trying to unlock more housing supply. But I think they need to focus on the fact that the development industry, the private sector, is best placed to deliver the majority of housing. So they need to kind of view their solutions through that lens. So at a federal level, are there certain incentives or disincentives? So carrot and stick approach, are there certain things, are there certain levers that the federal government can do to facilitate more housing development? Can they adjust the tax regime to promote more investment and delivery of housing? Can they do more in terms of bringing the state government and local governments to the table to fund certain projects or fund certain process improvements to facilitate that? At a federal level, the environmental laws are often seen as a massive risk factor for developers, especially when we talk about doing greenfield development. So this is development that is typically in newer emerging areas where there are environmental constraints or matters of national environmental significance. Think koala habitat, for example. You guys would know that when you see that kind of constraint for land, that could mean that you trigger the need for an assessment against the federal environmental protection laws, that means massive risk in terms of cost and timing and outcome. And so that lack of certainty is something that the federal government can start to address at that higher level. And they have been moving in that direction lately to try and improve or reform the national laws when it comes to environmental protection. So they are doing something. But I guess when it comes to any political policies, we're at this kind of whim of the four-year political cycle that you might have a change of government every 4 years, and that can have a massive kind of negative impact on any progress in that regard. So if we have a change of government, are they going to change their policies and processes? So if we can just be mindful of those things. But I guess moving down the tree or the hierarchy at a state level, again, there's been a lot of movement. There's been a lot of action by the former state government and the current state government to try and unlock more housing, to try and facilitate more streamlined approval processes, to fund infrastructure so that would allow developers to deliver more housing. But I guess it remains to be seen how effective that is. What we know is that we have these housing targets that we're not even close to meeting to accommodate our additional population growth. So the state government is doing things to try and unlock more housing. But I guess it's questionable as to whether or not they're actually hitting the targets.
Yeah. This topic is just like, we're in a housing crisis. We will be in a housing crisis for a long time. We're building nowhere near enough houses and there's no more land, right? The land that we have is the land that we have. And I'm specifically talking about Gold Coast. And housing crisis, why are we in a housing crisis? We have a supply and demand problem, right? And there's other issues. But there's more demand than there is supply, which is driving housing prices up and is driving building prices up. If there wasn't the demand there, right, then housing, like the tradies and the suppliers' prices would have to come down. And this is what boggles my mind when I talk to people about real estate and they're like, oh, the real estate market's going to crash and it's going to do this and it's going to do that. And I'm like, this is basic supply and demand. You tell me the last time, and I could be wrong, right, that a place was in a housing crisis, which means we're not building enough houses and they're too expensive and the market crashing at the same time. It contradicts itself. And we've been in a housing crisis for a long time. This isn't just like something that's happened over the last year. We've been in a housing crisis here for a long time. And I don't see anything in the future in any of the policies that will counteract that. And this is why I think there's an opportunity for people, right? And that's why I'm so passionate about real estate, is there's creativity that comes with this. What Shannon and Carson are doing in the land space, right, is creating supply for that demand. Or it could just stay as a cow paddock. It's up to, right? If they're not the ones putting their kahunas on the line and going, and their time and their effort and their money, they're not creating that 30 lot subdivision so Mrs. and, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones can actually purchase that land. And it irritates me when I hear people talk about this that don't have any education around this, and then they blame it, oh, it's because of immigration and it's because of this. But the thing is, the government has to be careful what they do, because they can't just stop immigration overnight, because majority of Australians' wealth is held in property, whether people like that or not, right? It's good for the people that don't own property. They don't give a shit about the people that own multiple properties. All they want is a cheap home to buy. And unfortunately, in my opinion, this crisis isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
I agree. Yeah, I couldn't agree more in terms of the focus should be on delivering, dealing with the supply issue, rather than trying to argue that we need to stop the demand. I don't think that's realistic. And I think, like you said, we need to be really careful about, you know, the messages we're sending and the type of levers that are being pulled by government to make sure that we don't send the wrong message and that we don't create uncertainty for the development industry, because that will be entirely counterproductive. So some of the issues, or some of the solutions, potential solutions that have been thrown around in recent times, include what's called inclusionary zoning. So this is a concept where the government mandates or requires a certain percentage of development to be provided for affordable or social housing. And if that's not done in a sensitive and responsible way, that can actually be quite counterproductive, because that can threaten the viability of housing projects, which means less houses get built rather than more. And the other side of potential solution being thrown around to try and limit land banking. So land banking is a concept whereby a property owner purchases a land and doesn't do anything with it, or obtains an approval and then just sits on that approval rather than acting upon it. And there's one suggestion that limiting the lifespan of an approval, also known as a currency period, so reducing the currency period to a shorter period of time, might encourage that development to be bought on sooner, this use it or lose it type concept. But again, I recommend exercising caution when it comes to those types of solutions, because again, they can be counterproductive. Because like I mentioned before, like this supply issue, this lack of housing supply, is a more macro issue than just, say, town planning related. It's a global one that relates to labor shortages, construction costs.
And what people aren't thinking about is, okay, who's going into these houses? On the Gold Coast specifically, there's a heap of houses that are just lockups from international foreign buyers that come and park money and lock the door, and it's safe. Then we're losing houses to Airbnb that are being, you know, rented in holiday, especially in holiday spots. Gold Coast is a holiday spot, so we lose thousands to Airbnb. And one big thing that people don't think about is divorce rates. Divorce rates are at all-time highs. So when you and your wife divorce, what happens? One house turns into two houses. So if you just do a quick calculation, right? I haven't done it, but for people out there, it would be interesting to say, what is the average divorce rate in Australia per year? It'll be in the tens of thousands, right? If not hundreds of thousands now. And that, you say if it was 100,000, you then, some people move with their mom and their dad or friends and family and the rest of it. Majority of people are going to go and get their own place. So that's another 100,000 units or houses that are now needed. So there's all these external pressures. Yes, and there's immigration, but it's not just immigration, you know? And these are all the other things that are putting pressure on it. And then the supply and builders and the rest of it. And again, this is why I think this is such a great opportunity, because what I love about real estate is this isn't just about buying a place, holding it for 10 years and hoping that it's going to go up and you're going to live the Australian dream. This is literally manufacturing growth and equity out of thin air. What Shannon and Carson and I do, right, even though I'm more built for their land, is we're creating and manufacturing equity and wealth, which then goes into your guys' pockets as well, right? And that generates the economy. If these guys aren't doing what they're doing, we'd be even in a tougher spot. And we're not talking about the stock land, you know, and the Mervax and these big guys. We need more smaller guys and women, want to say guys, you know, men and women, to think outside of the box and learn these things. Because one, you're solving a problem. And two, you're generating income and wealth creation for your family.
That's a really important message, I think, that will help solve, or at least go part way to helping solve the blockages to delivery of housing. In times past, development has been seen sometimes as a negative thing. Now we are in this acute housing crisis. I think a lot more people are coming to realize the value of development and the need for it. And that we can't just ignore it. We can't stifle it. It's critical that we facilitate good development. And educating the community is one of the key objectives to allowing that to occur. So I think the majority of people in the community can understand that in order to continue to enjoy the lifestyles that we've all become accustomed to, we can't just sit on our hands and ignore the problem.
No.
We need to take measures. We need to change the way we do things. We need to open the door up to greater development potential for good development outcomes. You talked about densification in our, you know, established high-rise areas. Yes, that's one key aspect to it. But you spoke again before about housing diversity. And it's not just about more apartments in high-rise buildings. It's about a diverse range of housing supply. So whether it's your detached dwellings on, you know, whether it's the larger acreage lots or the smaller sewered lots, it might be, you know, your townhouses. It might be, yeah, the granny flats out the back of existing houses. All those pieces of the puzzle can come together to allow us to start to chip away at this shortage of housing. But quite often what stands in the way is community opposition or political opposition, which is often the same thing, because some people don't want to see that type of development in their backyard. And so they stand in its way. And as a result, some of the politicians decide not to make those tough choices for the greater good. So that's a really kind of key point that I think you really nailed.
Yeah. There's definitely a balance, right? Like the reason why those people don't want it built is because it's going to impact their home, right? Their lifestyle. But the reality is there's other people that want to enjoy this lifestyle as well. Right? Specifically Australia, specifically, in my opinion, Gold Coast, right? And that's why there's so much demand coming to this region, because of the lifestyle and the weather and the beaches. Like, you talk to anyone that lives here, that travels the world, they come back, it's like, it's the best place. It's the best place, you know, on earth. And what I think we need to be more open into accepting these people that are coming here to live here, because just because we live here and we have the lifestyle doesn't mean it's only for us. And we have to bring them in with open arms and try and do as much as possible. Yes, there's going to be congestion. Yes, there's going to be bigger lineups. Yes, it's going to affect the quality of life that you had like 20 years ago when it was an old country town. But the reality is it's not an old country town anymore. It is a rapidly growing area. And if you actually want that, in my opinion, there's plenty of other places you can go to still get that and be on the same beach and probably more affordable, to be honest with you, and nice and quiet. But specifically for me, the Gold Coast, is changing because people want to be here. You can't the weather. We have beautiful weather, right? Over 300 days a year, we've got sunshine. We've got amazing beaches. It's hard to replicate that anywhere in the world. And for me, it's we need to embrace it. And I think the Gold Coast is doing a fairly reasonable job of doing that. And one of the issues because of that probably is a lot of these bigger built form high rise buildings are not being built because they're not feasible to be built. Mm. They're being sold off the plan and then realized, oh, we've got nobody to build it. And they're not there's that many development applications that are approved that haven't been built for years and years and years. And council's now coming out and trying to, change the rulings around those to say, if you have it for a certain amount of time or, the DA gets abolished and things like this, because they just can't make it happen.
Well, there's a lot of apartment buildings that are now, they're redoing the DAs. It might've been 40 units and they're doing one unit per level. That luxury market seems to stack up, but the affordable market just physically doesn't stack up. It's not even, yes, like any business, we need to make a margin, but the banks won't even fund us unless you're making 20%, maybe minimum 15% margin. So before the risk that you're taking, the market can go up, but the market can go down as well. So the banks won't even fund it. So that's what we're seeing, the solution in council and state size. I think we're, it might be 70 or 60%, detached housing. We want to move, flip that. So it's like 60, 70%, units moving forward. But the feasibility just doesn't work. It works in theory on a piece of paper, but the logical application of that actually, and I think state governments are starting to look into the feasibility of some of the things that they're bringing out because, in my eyes, I look at, Brisbane City Council, you've got 400 square metre lots. We've got 600 square metres here. We've got rural residential lots. We've got an average of 8,000 and a minimum of 4. And then you've got other rural residential lots in, say, Moreton Bay, you can do 3,000, but there's just a minimum of 4,000. So just with a stroke of a pen, you could double the amount of potential sites that could be subdivided. So I look at those to different councils and go, well, there's opportunities there and we can still protect the koalas and we can still protect the significant attributes of the site. Because at the end of the day, there's still, nobody wants bad development. So you've got the urban sprawl. Council don't want to be doing schools and dragging all the infrastructure they want to go up, and that makes sense. But it is a challenge, and I appreciate that, it's not as simple as just, rezoning swaths of land. But at the same time, units, it's not necessarily going to stack up. I don't think that's going to solve the problem until there's an adjustment there somewhere. So
what's encouraging is that for Gold Coast, council's currently preparing a new planning scheme, and that's expected to come into effect late 2027 at this stage. And so I think that's brought a fair amount of optimism in the development industry that with some good decision making, those opportunities can be realised. So in terms of the audience out there, if they're interested in property development and what future opportunities might exist, there's some insight there that can be gained by following how that new planning scheme is developed and delivered. And the same can be said for Southeast Queensland or the nation more broadly, is that town planning isn't a kind of set and forget exercise. It's something that's constantly changing. The planning controls are constantly being updated and evolving to deal with these modern problems. And so being kind of ahead of the curve, and being mindful that those controls might change is probably something that's really valuable to people like yourselves that are interested in property acquisition and development, is understanding where those high-level strategic planning documents are seeing the next generation of development occurring. So in Southeast Queensland or Queensland more broadly, we have what's called regional plans that the state produces. So those regional plans identify those development go and no-go zones, so urban footprints, and typically development is sought to be limited to within a certain footprint in these regions. but they also sometimes identify areas for potential future growth, investigation areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so if your audience is interested in where might the next wave of development be occurring, especially when you're looking for projects that might involve residential subdivision or land development, having a look at those regional strategic planning documents can often provide some really good insight. And just being dialed into the wealth of information that's put out there on the internet every day. Council meetings often have reports being presented and spoken to that do provide a lot of really good insight about where the next big infrastructure project is going to go. And then that can lead to some assumptions about, well, what might follow in terms of other development? What type of development can that infrastructure actually support, whether it's a new trunk sewer main or a new road or a new train station? You can start to see how that is then going to inform you about what opportunities might lie ahead in terms of that property development space.
And that's why it's so important, guys, like I said, mentioned before, to sit down with a town planner, because you might not have a site, but if you go and sit down with a town planner and pay for their time and say, listen, I want to see these regional reports. Can you show me a little bit about the new city plan and what they're talking about and what areas they're talking about? Because what Harley's trying to do here is dodge the bullet of telling us where we should be investing. So in a good way.
Well, on that, I want to ask the question.
Just call
if you wake up tomorrow and you got an epiphany and you're going to quit planning, but you want to do your first project.
Make sure you call us first.
What are you doing? Are you...
Look, I mean, I'm not a property developer, but I think it's safe to say that the end goal of property development is to make money, right? You're not in it for the fun of it. So I guess you're thinking about the type of projects that you want to get involved in. You want to make sure that there's going to be a demand for that particular product or that development and something you're going to be able to sell for a profit in the future. So yeah, we've already spoken to the obvious one, which is housing. I can't see there being a time in our lives where there won't be a high demand for housing in this part of the world.
Mm.
So, any project that involves the delivery of housing, I think, is one worthy of consideration. But you've got to make it stack, right? It's got to be something that's profitable. You've got to get a certain yield. And that's about understanding where those constraints and opportunities might lie. But if we go back to, I guess, what I was saying before about looking at those high-level strategic planning documents and where they foresee the next waves of development occurring, I suppose, in our backyard. There are certainly areas out in the scenic rim, perhaps south of Ipswich, southwest of Logan, that have been identified for those future investigation areas. There's other areas between Brisbane and the Sunshine Coast as well, Toowoomba. Areas where the state government has said, look, we think these areas are worth investigating, but you need to be mindful that that's a long-term play.
Mm.
The infrastructure is not there yet. So just being mindful, keeping those areas on your radar and checking in on a regular basis to see what's happening in terms of government decisions or property sales in particular. So I think a lot can be gained from being aware of what property is changing hands and who the players are.
Yeah, and who's buying.
Correct? Because the big property developers, some of them might be investing in areas while divesting in other areas.
Yeah. I say this a lot as well is, the Bunnings of the world, the Maccas of the world, the Big W's of the world would spend millions, tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars probably, in regards to due diligence and where they're going to be building their new stores and the infrastructure. So sometimes you just got to follow those breadcrumbs. You don't need to be a rocket scientist. What you need to be is inquisitive and just, I guess, determined and consistent, right, with looking at those areas. So what you said there, I don't want you guys to overlook this, right? Those areas that Harley mentioned, you can now go to those areas, set search results in Real Commercial and realestate.com and start seeing what's being sold, what's coming up for sale, and who's buying. Because all you got to do is type in Australia top 10 land developers, right? And if the articles that are coming up, that they're starting to buy big parcels of land, big farms and stuff like that. You know what's coming. It's not more horse stables, right? It's going to be housing. So,
but the opportunity for mum and dads, the big guys don't want to play in that sub 50 lots or even 4 lots or 10 lots. So there is that opportunity in that space. If you can, you know, you cut your teeth doing those 1-2s, 1-3s or duplex and triplex. But when you get out of that mum and dad bracket and into between the bigger guys and where the mum and dad investors want to play, there's a little sweet spot there where you can carve out a nice little business.
So, yeah. And for those listening, I don't want you guys using I have no money as an excuse, because these two guys that are sitting on this panel right now did their first how many projects with no money?
About 6 or 7.
6 or 7 projects, land subdivision projects, with none of their own money, and they've made plenty of money doing it. And Harley loves every minute of it because he knows that he's got amazing clients that are just going to continue to do amazing things. Because I've seen how these guys were talking off of camera of Harley, and obviously what Shannon said, how your mind is just a little bit different. And it intrigues me to get into discussions with you. So I just want to say thank you so much for being here today with us. And having a bit of a laugh and just diving deep into this topic and this subject and breaking it down for the audience, because we have people that are seasoned veterans and we'll have people that are just newbies that are just thinking of a different way, that all they want is that one property deal that can change their life, that can change their family's life and start getting on that path of wealth creation. So thank you very much, Harley, for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What's the best way of getting in contact with Harley Day and RPS? Is it email? Or?
Yeah, look, you can find me on our website, RPS,
yeah.
Or you can just email me directly at harley.day@rpsconsulting.com.
That's harley.day@rpsconsulting.com. No AU, just .com. And again, Shannon, Carson, as usual, thank you very much for adding so much value. And hopefully you guys like that one, guys. There's plenty of information there. Please share it around, like it, subscribe it. We're going to keep continuing adding value in this property space and bringing experts like Harley on more and more for you guys. Share it around and we'll see you on the next one. Thank you.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.